From the campus of Yale University, this is Business Talk with Jim Campbell, coming to you from 1540 WADK Newport. I'll talk on all business, 60 minutes of radio with leading figures from the world of business, along with the business of politics and sports. Investigating a global financial scandal, the fix was in on the setting of the ubiquitous LIBOR interest rates, manipulating the London Interbank Offering Rate that impacts almost every loan imaginable, from your credit card to your car to your house and more. David Enrich is the financial enterprise editor for the Wall Street Journal, heading up a team of investigative reporters, previously served as the journal's European banking editor based in London. He's also a loyal Red Sox fan, which we're going to try not hold against him. And his latest book is a mouthful, so give me a second. The Spider Network, the wild story of a math genius, a gang of bank-stabbing bankers, and one of the greatest scams in history. Welcome, David. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
What is a financial enterprise editor?
It is an editor. It's basically a vague title that enables me to do more or less what I want, which is really fun. I run a small group of investigative reporters digging into all manner of financial shenanigans on Wall Street and elsewhere.
Sounds cool. It's like kind of like a dream job.
It is pretty cool.
This, before we get into what exactly the LIBOR scandal was, where does this scandal fit in your mind in the scale versus the mortgage crisis in 08 and insider trading?
It is not as big as the mortgage crisis and the financial crisis, and it is bigger than insider trading, I would argue. But all three of those, and these are kind of the three marquee scandals of the past decade or two, and they all have one thing in common, which is that they were all precipitated by the same broken culture in the financial system. And that's a desire, and in fact a mandate, for people to push as far as they could to make as much money as quickly as possible, with basically no consideration of the rules, the ethics, the morals, the costs to society, or the cost to other people that the banks were dealing with. And it was the industry was, and to a certain extent remains, a really amoral place. And it's that culture that led pretty directly, I would argue, to all three of these scandals.
Very, very interesting. Yeah, you do see some commonalities coming up and up again. All right, as we jump into this, tell folks, first of all, what is the LIBOR?
So LIBOR, it is an acronym. It stands for the London Interbank Offered Rate, and it is probably the most important number that you've never heard of or never paid any attention to. So every day around lunchtime in London, a group of about 15 banks, and these are banks from London, from elsewhere in Europe, from Asia, from the United States, that each of them estimates, theoretically, how much it would cost each of them to borrow money from another bank. And if that sounds kind of theoretical and arbitrary, it is. These numbers are largely concocted out of thin air by relatively low-level people within the bank. They each send an email with this number every day around lunchtime over to a trade group in London called the British Bankers Association. It then tosses out the high and low estimates and averages out the rest, and presto, you have LIBOR. So why does LIBOR matter? The LIBOR matters because it serves as the basis for the interest rates people and institutions pay on much of the debt in the world. So, for example, if you have a variable rate mortgage, the interest rate you're paying is likely based on LIBOR. If you have credit card balance, the interest you're paying on that is likely based on LIBOR. If you have a student loan, an auto loan, LIBOR. If you are a big company and you're borrowing money, the interest rate you're paying on that debt is often based on LIBOR. If you're a town or a city or a state and you're borrowing money, the same goes. And so this is LIBOR underpins interest rates on trillions of dollars of financial contracts all over the world. And even though it's always in the fine print and very few people pay attention to it, it has very small movements in it, up or down on a daily basis, have the potential to cost or make millions of dollars for all manner of people all over the world. And so it's often referred to as the world's most important number. And the scandal erupted because about 15 years ago, a group of bankers, mostly in London, realized that no one was paying any attention to how this rate was set. There was no oversight. There was no regulation. In fact, this is just really the province of some pretty low-level clerks within these giant banks. And a number of traders realized that it wouldn't take much for them to just call in a favor or two and ask their colleagues in the bowels of these big institutions if they could maybe do a small favor and move LIBOR up or down by very small margins in ways that almost no one would notice, but that had the potential to turn into pretty big profits for the bankers themselves. And so that's what happened. And this started in probably the mid-90s, and you know, as these things tend to, no one noticed, but it was very successful, and so it gained momentum and became more and more prevalent in the banking industry. By the mid-2000s, and this is the time right before the financial crisis, where there is a real anything-goes mentality in the U.S., in London, and elsewhere in the world, it got taken to a new higher level by a group of especially audacious bankers. And that's what really turned this into a scandal. They finally pushed a little too far, and that got the attention of the media, which then led to attention from regulators, which then led to attention from prosecutors.
Interesting. The media before the regulators who were asleep. We'll get to that. And before we get to some of the guys that were involved, to me it was surprising when I think of over here the Fed setting interest rates and the secrecy. I mean, you're not even allowed to bring a phone, I don't think, into the building there in Washington, nor electronics. And yet this hugely important rate is set by clerks?
Yeah, there are a lot of places in the financial system where there are just these kind of kinks that have never been ironed out. I kind of compare it to the keyboards that we now use on computer, which have this weird, if you think about it, the layout of the letters in a keyboard are really weird, the QWERTY layout.
Right.
And that's a function of, you know, typewriters back in the olden days.
Right.
They needed to have it so that the keys wouldn't actually jam, so they wanted to slow down the process of typing. And of course, these days that doesn't matter because your keys aren't going to jam on a modern keyboard, but we still have this very inefficient, old-fashioned way of doing something very fundamental that's deeply ingrained in the system. And the same is true for LIBOR. There's no reason nowadays to have this theoretical, unsupervised instrument as the basis for much of the modern financial world, and yet it's so deeply ingrained in the DNA of the financial system that it's almost impossible to get it out.
Okay, let's get to Tom Hayes now, sort of the central character in this story. And you can tell us about him, but first, how did you get to me, this is one of the great stories ever told, and you wrote this famous, like, article in the front page of the Journal, I think, if I remember.
Yep.
And how did you get close to this guy?
I think it's probably easier to, before getting into how I met him, to just kind of explain how he landed in as the kind of ringleader of this, because he was working for a number of these banks, and as I said earlier, the mandate on these bankers at this point and these traders was to find small edges that they could exploit. And Hayes was really, that was something he was really good at. He could spot these patterns, he could see these numbers in his mind in a way very few people could. And so, and he saw very quickly that everyone was kind of subtly and not very ambitiously trying to get LIBOR moved in beneficial directions, but he saw ways to do it in a much more ambitious, much more creative, much more coordinated way, and he did it with great success. So I got to know Hayes because I was working at the Wall Street Journal in the London Bureau in early 2013, and when Hayes was criminally charged as the mastermind of the scandal by the Justice Department in the U.S. And basically did not have any interest in writing about this, if I'm honest about it. My boss forced me to, and we had a big argument about whether or not this was a worthwhile use of my time to delve into a big profile of the mastermind of this scandal. I thought it was impossible. My boss insisted that I do it, and, you know, luckily for me, he was the boss. As much as we journalists like to think that what we're doing is useful, that it's generally not a good idea for someone in that situation to talk to a reporter. And that night, I was sitting at home on my sofa with my wife, and my iPhone buzzed, and it was a text message from a number I didn't recognize, and it said, "This goes much, much higher than me. Not even the Justice Department knows the full story." And the message was from Tom Hayes, and he agreed to meet me the following day. He told me he'd meet me outside of Burger King in a very crowded train station in central London.
Wow.
He'd be wearing a brown leather jacket. And, you know, I'm kind of thinking to myself that I've just stumbled onto the set of, like, All the President's Men.
So I was going to say Deep Throat comes to mind.
Yeah, exactly. And I was feeling pretty good about myself. Until the next morning, I got another text message from him canceling the meeting because his wife had found his phone and saw that he was texting a reporter and put a stop to this nonsense. But despite that setback, I managed over the coming weeks and months to start kind of establishing pretty regular, consistent contact with Hayes, mostly over text message. And he started painting this picture for me of this wild world that, even though I'd been covering the banking industry and the financial system for many years at that point for the Wall Street Journal, I realized that I had no idea about the depth of scandal that was going on and just the institutionalized nature of it, and not to mention the really colorful characters who were involved in it. And so that was a start for me of a relationship with Hayes, and subsequently with Hayes' family, his wife, and other family members, that it serves as, I would say, the backbone of this book, because it allowed me, in a way that I don't think has been done before, to really not only tell the inside story of a financial scandal, but tell the story about the humans involved in that scandal, and kind of have as a narrative arc of the story the rise and fall of this really unlikely villain.
You're listening to Business Talk with Jim Campbell, Mondays through Friday from 1 to 2 p.m. right here on 1540 a.m. WADK Newport, or streaming live at WADK.com.
Hi, I'm Robert Reese, and if you'd like to learn from the top CEOs in America, join me weekday afternoons at 5 p.m. for the Best of the CEO Forum on 1540 AM WADK, Newport, Rhode Island.
David Enrich is the financial enterprise editor for the Wall Street Journal, heading up a team of investigative reporters. Is this, I ask this on insider trading, the show we did recently, does the culture had become so prevalent that everybody felt they had to do something like this just to compete? And what I mean by, I compare that to steroids in baseball, where the sort of the ownership was overlooking it, but everybody felt they had to do it because everybody else was?
Well, as with baseball, and you mentioned I'm a Red Sox fan, so let's not go too far down with this analogy, but not everyone was using steroids in baseball. And similarly, not everyone in banking was cheating. But, you know, there were a lot of people, a lot of the high performers who actually were. And I think this is a direct outgrowth of how traders are taught to define and understand their jobs, which is that they're not just trying to make smart investments. That's very old-fashioned and quaint. What they're trying to do is find an edge. And an edge can come in any number of forms. It can be that you have better information than your competitors. It can be that you have dumber clients than your competitors. It can be that you have better technology, better, faster trading systems than your competitors. Or it can be that you have found a subtle way to kind of nudge things that make you a lot of money. And so that's what this group of traders did. They found a way to have an edge, an inefficiency that they could exploit, a weakness, a loophole in the system that no one else had really thought of before. And then it gave them a very small edge. But when you're dealing with numbers in the billions, and that's what these guys are trading, very small changes can make a very big difference.
Did Hayes understand, because they see seeing the world so black and white and socially awkward, did he understand exactly what he was doing? Because he wasn't subtle about this. I mean, he'd come in and, you know, basically out loud, even people he hadn't met, asked that he wanted to get this interest rate set up or down a little bit. And did he know what he was doing? And did he see himself at the center of the cabal?
No. Well, he knew what he was doing. And I think he knew in the back of his mind that what he was doing was not quite right. Mm-hmm. But he allowed himself, he told himself that, A, this is something he sees going on around him all the time, and therefore it can't be that bad. And B, his bosses knew about what he was doing, and in some cases condoned what he was doing, and in some cases even participated alongside of him. And, you know, for most of us, or certainly for myself, I was brought up being trained that just because you see everyone else around you doing something that's wrong doesn't mean it's okay for you to do it too. And I think that's a principle that is often forgotten, sometimes willfully forgotten, in the banking industry. And Hayes certainly knew that some of the things he was doing, he was pushing the envelope. I think he thought, though, that generally what he was doing was basically that the industry, you were expected to push the envelope a bit. And maybe he was pushing a little too far at times, but generally he was doing some variation on what a lot of other people were doing. He certainly didn't see himself as being the center of this cabal or being a criminal genius the way he would soon be portrayed. And as I mean, I got to know him pretty well and got to know some of his family members pretty well and some of his childhood friends pretty well. And that's not who this guy is. This is not, which is not to say he didn't do anything wrong, but it's, this is not the banking villain out of Central Casting or the Wolf of Wall Street type. This is a guy who's, you know, much happier going home after a hard day at work and eating a bucket of fried chicken, having a glass of orange juice and watching Seinfeld reruns than he is going to a Michelin-starred restaurant or a fancy club. And he's someone who he just wasn't really that interested in most of the material aspects of this. This is someone who was prided himself on doing a good job, wanted to win, wanted his institution, his employers to win, and set out to do that in a very aggressive, very ambitious, very creative way that was not appropriate.
Just the magnitude is unbelievable. He could, on a one basis point change in the rate, could make him $2 million more. In one basis, there's 100 basis points to a 1% change.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about some of the culture there that the bank seemed to allow and how he there was almost a form of bribery that allowed him to pull this off.
Yeah, I mean, the culture, so I had always been kind of a cynic about the banking industry. I knew the culture was pretty bad.
Yeah.
I'd obviously seen all the movies that everyone else has seen, and I'd witnessed some of this behavior firsthand, but I was totally unprepared for the depths of this as I started to dig into it more. I mean, this is an industry where it's okay. The entire industry is predicated on this quid pro quo nature, where if you give me something of value, I'll give you something else of value in return, which sounds like that's maybe just capitalism, but here's how it works. So if you are willing to get LIBOR moved slightly in a favorable direction, you don't get in exchange someone else's help in the future. What you get is sometimes you get money, sometimes you get fancy trips or really expensive meals. You get things that are pretty easy to construe as bribes. And this is something that is deeply ingrained in the industry's culture, not just with LIBOR, but throughout. I mean, the brokerage industry, at least at the time this was going on, was for every $100 of commissions that a trader generated for a broker, a substantial part of that, like $5 or $10, so 5 or 10%, was going back to the trader in the form of entertainment, which meant that these traders, some of them would generate tens if not hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue for these brokers, and they were getting just enormous sums back in this extremely lavish, over-the-top entertainment. I mean, being taken to prostitutes in Morocco, being ferried all over the world, first class to the top five-star ski resorts, Saint-Tropez, places like that. And this is something that everyone knew was going on. The high-up senior executives of these institutions knew what was going on. It was an open secret.
You're listening to Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell. We'll have more with David Enrich of the Wall Street Journal. When we get back, we'll look into how they got caught. I'm Jim Campbell, host of Business Talk with Jim Campbell. We're honored to be joining 1540 AM WADK weekdays, 1 to 2 p.m., Monday through Fridays. We're so honored to have listeners in Middletown, Portsmouth, Tiverton, Jamestown, and, of course, Newport. Monday through Friday, 1 to 2 p.m. right here on 1540 AM WADK Newport.
Would you like to host your own radio program or podcast? Park City Productions 06604 is a Bridgeport, Connecticut-based radio broadcast solutions company. Follow us on Instagram, like us on Facebook, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. That's Park City Productions 06604. Call us at 203-522-8801.
From Philly to Fresno, Brooklyn to Boston, Data Cable Superstars has the best prices on installation of Cat 5 and Cat 6 wiring for cameras, computers, phone, and data, specializing in off-peak installs as to not interrupt your workflow. If this is an I-need-it-done-yesterday situation, then it's time to call Data Cable Superstars at 203-942-1427 or go to datacablesuperstars.com. That's datacablesuperstars, all one word, .com. Data Cable Superstars, where estimates and big ideas are always free. We're back with David Enrich. He's the author of The Spider Network, The Wild Story of a Math Genius, A Gang of Backstabbing Bankers, and One of the Greatest Scams in History. Tell us now a little bit. The regulators are asleep, and the bank management is sort of almost willfully blind to this, which sort of sets this. Talk a little bit about that, and then how do they get caught?
So I'm not sure I would describe the management as willfully blind. I mean, they were, in some cases, pretty aware of this, I would say. And again, this is a pattern in the financial industry. Managers and executives are really happy with anything as long as it's making a lot of money. The problems start arising if it loses money. And so we see this, and this pattern repeats itself over and over and over again. And it was the case here as well, that for the longest time, people knew, or at least should have known, what was going on with LIBOR. But it was really inconvenient and painful to look the other, to do anything about it, because, you know, it was very profitable. So this went along, this is working all very nicely for everyone, until early 2008, when the Wall Street Journal, and this had nothing to do with me, it was some of my predecessors in the London Bureau, wrote a couple of front-page stories pointing out that LIBOR seemed to be acting in very erratic ways, and it seemed that someone was manipulating it. And these stories, at least at the time on the surface, didn't seem to have a huge impact, but and most government agencies in the world didn't even, I'm not even sure they read them, but one little underfunded, kind of obscure government agency in Washington called the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, an investigator there did pick up the Wall Street Journal that morning and saw this and was intrigued and started digging. And for the next 2 or 3 years, he and a small group of his agents were kind of on a very lonely mission to try and figure out how LIBOR worked and what was wrong with it. And that was not only challenging because the banks resisted and the British Bankers Association, which is the organization running LIBOR, resisted, but also regulators in other, both in the U.S. and the U.K. as well, were really resistant to the idea of there being an active investigation of something like this, because LIBOR is so deeply ingrained in the financial system, and the knowledge of how it worked was so high up in not only the financial system, but also at central banks and places like that, that it was very unnerving to think about an investigation that could really expose everything that was going on, I think. And nonetheless, this investigation that the CFTC was doing kind of plowed forward and eventually managed to get other bank or other regulators and law enforcement on board because of just the power of the evidence that they were finding. And this happened to coincide, I think, very helpfully for the regulators with the end of the financial crisis, because as the crisis ended, there was an enormous amount of public pressure on politicians and prosecutors to find some individuals to hold account for the financial crisis and the enormous damage that the banking industry inflicted on the country and on the world, really. And I think most of what people really wanted to see in the public was some CEOs or at least senior executives hauled off to court in handcuffs. But what the LIBOR scandal showed was that there was really powerful evidence to support criminal charges against some people fairly low down in the pecking order. And, you know, a normal kind of ambitious creative prosecutor would probably try and take that evidence and leverage that to build cases against people higher up the food chain. What in fact happened is that Tom Hayes became the boogeyman. And partially, I think, because of his mild autism, he had committed everything he was doing in writing or over recorded phone lines. So there was just reams of documentary evidence that were just quite damning. And so this is how Hayes got charged and how all these institutions, this is all really brought to light.
Did they make him the fall guy?
He certainly was the one guy to fall for it. Whether that fall guy obviously has kind of connotes that he doesn't deserve to have been punished, and I'm not sure I agree with that, because I think he does deserve to be punished. He was doing something that was wrong, either knew it was wrong or should have known it was wrong. But he, as far as I can tell, Hayes was convicted in 2015 and originally sentenced to 14 years in prison. So he's currently in a maximum security prison, and he's in there with violent drug criminals, murderers. His best friend in prison is actually a guy serving a very long sentence for murdering his financial advisor.
Which I thought was appropriate for the book.
Yeah, exactly. It's very karmic justice, maybe.
David, while you're on that, what is the maximum sentence anybody else got for this?
For LIBOR. I mean,
for LIBOR.
There was a couple people who got sentenced to a year or two.
But 1 year or two versus 14, and the rest got vindicated, right?
Right, well, or exonerated and acquitted or just not charged at all, or are, in some cases, still at fairly senior levels elsewhere in the financial industry. Mm-hmm. And Hayes, as far as I can tell, is not only the only one really nailed for LIBOR, but is, as far as I can tell, the only banker in the world right now who's currently in prison for crimes committed during the financial crisis.
It's just mind-boggling. Let me ask you this, because I've seen this now in several different cases. He cooperates initially, right? And they've got 5,000 hours of tapes and stuff. And these guys are traders. They manage risk. And I saw this with Raj Rajaratnam and Matthew Martoma. They made really dumb decisions to try and fight the feds, essentially, and then they get these bad sentences. Why did he decide to do that?
Well, Hayes' decision was even worse than Raj's or Martoma's, because he initially cooperated with the British prosecutors.
Right.
And he, and you said 5,000 hours. It was actually 82 hours. So that's still a lot of taped confessions that he gave to the British prosecutors. And after having given those taped confessions, decided, never mind, I'm going to actually plead not guilty and try and fight this. And I have spent, I was talking with Hayes multiple times a day at the point where he made this decision. So I think I knew him better than almost anyone in the world. And I do not understand to this day why he made the decision he did. And he, his public explanation for it is that he had a, and there's some truth to this. So he originally decided to cooperate with the British government because he was hoping that they would charge him because he did not want to be extradited to the U.S. And under British double jeopardy rules, if you're facing similar charges in the U.K., you can't be extradited to another jurisdiction to face the same charges. And so because he had a family in England and, you know, the U.S. tends to dispense tougher sentences in worse jail conditions than the U.K., and so he gambled that it would be better for him to be charged in the U.K. than in the U.S., and the easiest way to do that was to cooperate so that they would have an unassailable case against him. The crazy decision, though, is them changing your mind. He says that he could not bear the thought of living with having admitted to being a criminal if he didn't really believe he was a criminal, and having to tell, he has a son who is now about 5 years old, so at the time was probably 2 or 3 years old, who he said he couldn't bear the thought of his son Joshua growing up and thinking that his dad was an admitted criminal. And I mean, these are understandable sentiments to have. It's not, but it's, as you said earlier, these are, this is a guy who is a very accomplished trader. He's supposed to be expert at weighing, you know, costs and benefits and risks and things like that. And this was a crazy decision he made. Crazy.
We've got our final segment coming up. Moral of the story.
This is Robert Reese. We're here today with Ralph De La Vega, CEO of AT&T Mobility. You did a merger of 60,000 employees in 19 days. Talk about that.
The DOJ and the FCC gave us the approval on October the 26th. We had to get the companies to operate as one by November the 15th, right before the heavy Thanksgiving holidays, which is when sales activity picks up for wireless in the fourth quarter. So we had to make a call. Can we merge these two companies? Can these people act as one? 60,000 people in 19 days, even though we didn't know each other. Our chief executive at the time, Stan Sigman, asked me, Ralph, do you think you can do it? I said, 19 days, but not a minute less.
And the analyst said it wouldn't work.
Not only did we do the merger in 19 days, but in the critical fourth quarter, when the analyst said that we were going to lose lines, we had a record number of customer additions in the fourth quarter. In fact, we had the largest number of customer net additions in the history of wireless in the fourth quarter for the U.S.
Thanks, Ralph. This is Robert Reese. Today we spoke with Ralph De La Vega of AT&T Mobility about how having the right plan and a passionate team can accomplish what others say can't be done. Tomorrow we'll talk with Ralph about the future of mobility.
Hi, I'm Robert Reese. If you'd like to learn from the top CEOs in America, join me every Monday through Friday at 5 p.m. for the Best of the CEO Forum on 1540 AM WADK.
I'm Jim Campbell, host of Business Talk with Jim Campbell. We're honored to be joining 1540 AM WADK weekdays, 1 to 2 p.m., Monday through Fridays. We're so honored to have listeners in Middletown, Portsmouth, Tiverton, Jamestown, and, of course, Newport. Monday through Friday, 1 to 2 p.m. right here on 1540 AM WADK Newport. We're back with our final segment, David Enrich, financial enterprise editor at the Wall Street Journal. First off, I guess you sort of started this way. Based on this culture, are financial scandals almost inevitable even still?
Yes, is the short answer. The longer answer is that I think right now the industry culture is probably in the best shape it's been in since I started focusing on this stuff 15 years ago at least. I mean, the industry has been so badly burned by crisis and scandal after scandal that there's a really high premium placed on good behavior and on culture. My fear, though, is that as memories fade of the financial crisis and of all these multi-billion dollar fines the banks have paid to settle charges against them, as those memories fade, the premium that people put on good behavior and on ethics is going to be basically overtaken by the priority of just making as much money as quickly as possible at virtually any cost. And that's the long-standing prevailing culture in the industry, and it has a very clear pattern in empirical history of producing toxic results. And I think before too terribly long we'll be back in that mode again. And you know, we've all seen how that movie ends.
Well, we want to keep your folks fully employed there in the investigative unit.
I think the journalists are the ones that are probably the biggest winners of that.
By the way, I got the best understanding of the trading culture that I'd ever seen before. And I don't know if this was talking to a shrink that when you got to this part of the book. It's not just greed. It's not just money. It's about winning. And it's about not letting institutional control stop you from self-actualizing, reaching your peak the way they view it, which is kind of interesting. So it's, and then you put that with amorality, in other words.
Yeah, and this is that was actually, I did talk to a number of psychologists for this book. That was actually, the words you just paraphrased are from a former trader himself, a guy who got kicked out of the industry for his own bad behavior, and he was unusually introspective and thoughtful on the stuff. This is also a guy, though, who told me a story about how during the 9/11 attacks, he was sitting, he worked for a big bank that had offices in both London and New York. And in New York, the offices were in the World Trade Center. And he was in London and watching this on TV, watching quite likely his colleagues dying. And he didn't stop trading. And his colleagues didn't either. They all kept going, like thinking of ways to make money off of this. And in fact, dozens of his colleagues were killed. And that only troubled him weeks later.
Another thing that I find interesting in that the senior management pushes them to even double down to make money, which tells me they don't really understand their own risk management, and then says, oh, these are rogue traders. But rogue traders become part of their system, so by definition, they're not really rogue, right?
The risk management at a lot of these institutions, at least historically, was that we manage problems after they arise. There's no thought. And taking more risk was seen as a way of making more money. There was no thought given at most of these institutions to the possibility that taking more risk could have, you know, it could, these trades go both ways. So for every trade, there's a winner and a loser. And the, and this is why the banking industry kept getting in so much trouble and caused this huge crisis, because the notion of risk management was really, that was not something that was seen as a moneymaker in this industry. It was not something that was a prized, kind of respected role.
It's out that Gary Cohen is even talking about Glass-Steagall coming back, or at least separating consumer lending from investment banking. What do you think about that? These guys, it's sort of a casino.
To be honest, I don't know what I think of that. That's, I personally think that the bigger and more aggressive banks get, the higher the likelihood of them inflicting damage on the rest of the financial system and the rest of the economy becomes. So I think that's a pattern that's been borne out over in many centuries of financial crises. Bigger financial institutions also can lower costs and make borrowing more plentiful. And so you kind of need to weigh these different benefits and different risks against each other. But the notion that someone like Gary Cohn, who has built his entire career on Wall Street and is a really aggressive guy on Wall Street as well, working at Goldman, mm-hmm. is now embracing this kind of populist mantra that we need to break up the banks, or that we need to reintroduce the things that were...
It is stunning.
It's absolutely stunning.
Have they fixing the LIBOR? Is it no longer possible? How is it working now?
Well, it's still in the process of being fixed. There's and it's much easier said than done, because LIBOR is so, it's just institutionalized in all of these financial contracts all over the world, trillions and trillions of dollars of it. So you can't just wave a magic wand and say, okay, LIBOR now, the definition has changed to this, or we're not going to use LIBOR anymore. It's just, you would need to renegotiate just a number of contracts that is almost impossible to even quantify. So there's no good answer is the short answer. The bottom line, though, is that there's been so much scrutiny on LIBOR and so much attention in the media and from regulators and from the banks themselves that I think it's pretty unlikely that that's where we're going to see another scandal arise. I think it's very likely, however, that as memories fade of the bad behavior and the costs that it had for the industry and for the economy, that there are going to be other similar scandals of traders finding new edges to exploit, new ways to exploit them, and no one stops them until they start losing money.
I guess human behavior wins out in the end. All right,
absolutely.
As we finish up, tell us how Tom Hayes is doing in prison right now, and how his wife's doing, and how things are going in the family there.
Hayes is not doing well. He's deeply depressed. He's extremely angry. He has really struggled to find an outlet for those emotions. His main outlet is he is a fairly scrawny guy, not always with the best hygiene. And he, the last time I saw him, which was about 6 months ago, 8 months ago maybe, he was bulging with muscles and had been spending an enormous amount of time in the gym and is in really good physical condition, at least. His wife is struggling too. She is she works full time. She's essentially a single mother at this point, and is consumed by this. And she defines herself by this, and that's really hard.
Boy, it sounds brutal. Are they smoking and all that stuff? I mean, are they taking care of their health? It sounds like he's working out. And
well, yeah, I don't. I mean, the last I saw. I think they're physically probably taking decent care of themselves. I don't think they're smoking or drinking that much anymore, but I feel like the mental toll that almost this anger and depression takes on someone
takes
is pretty – it overcomes any benefit from not smoking.
When's the earliest he can get out?
He needs to serve – the maximum he can serve in prison is 6 years, and so that would be – in 2021 or 2022, he could get out.
So how old would he be then?
He will be in his mid-40s.
Okay, so he has his chance at a second deal, right?
He does, although, again, I think the biggest risk to that is that he will have basically made himself insane.
Really?
We'll see. Maybe that'll be the sequel.
Wow. All right, well, that was a fun and quick hour. Thanks to David Enrich. That book, again, is The Spider Network, The Wild Story of a Math Genius, a Gang of Backstabbing Bankers, one of the greatest scams in history. You'll really enjoy reading it. We'll see everybody again tomorrow at 1 p.m. for another edition of Business Talk with Jim Campbell right here on Newport's News and Talk Station, 1540 AM WADK, and streaming at WADK.com everywhere.